Good Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
There's that moment of silence between one jingle and the next. Just a moment. And you go into it and you go, it's probably not going to fart, and you crash it. Sorry. The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, an award winner at Global Finance, the Innovators 2021. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. Lots of power industry news today, most of it about the darkness, but we'll talk about that in just a second. Interesting this evening to see commentary from Kulu Pasiwe. That name ring any bells to you? Well, it should. Up until about 2 years ago, he was the official spokesperson for Eskom. Had a hell of a time, rough time. Very, very effective spokesperson, put his mind and body on the line for Eskom. Not that he got too much thanks for it, and he's moved on, and I think he'll probably be a lot happier for it. But Kulu Pasiwe is saying tonight on Twitter, and I take it from whence it comes because he is a credible source when it comes to matters Eskom, South Africa has got enough and capable engineers to end load shedding. Engineers thrive on solving problems, he says. Imagine the major switch they've had to make from designing 50-meter-high radio telescopes to designing ventilators from scratch. If we give engineers space, time and resources, we shall be pleasantly surprised with what they can do in breaking the back of load shedding. What is it with our aversion to getting the old toppies who understand where the wires go and are committed to getting the job done back and involved, I wonder, on a day where the chief, power station manager at Kuberg has been, according to reports I see this evening, suspended for underperformance. It's time for a radical overhaul, perhaps, of the way in which Eskom is run. We'll talk to Gary McNamara at Sundown Private Wealth tonight about today's market activity. Fascinating new developments in the battle for adept IT. Language like unfair but reasonable. Unfair and unreasonable. Fair and reasonable. It's all moving in the right direction, but my goodness gracious me. And then a fabulous brand coming out of Lesotho this evening in our Friday file. It's called Barali, and it is using indigenous skills, and it is using indigenous materials from Lesotho to make beautiful things. We'll play the Brutal Biz quiz in between 7 and 8 tonight. We'll bring you some of the best bits from the week that has been.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, the real test of whether South Africa will get those Turkish car power ships to deliver energy to the grid over an extended period will be on how they are paid for. APSA has come out today and said it'll tread cautiously in evaluating any funding proposals, and you can bet others will as well. There'll be a huge amount of caution in dealing with them, considering the huge number of allegations of irregularities surrounding the tender. Acting APSA Chief Executive Jason Quinn, asked by the shareholder activists Just Share at the AGM if they would finance the vessels, and Jason Quinn saying, "We are not about to give away our reputation that we have built on one transaction." It's been a horrific week from a load shedding perspective across South Africa, and it's caused all kinds of knock-on problems. Many of you in the dark for days on end as power grids and power systems fail. And it seems to have been amplified, certainly in Joburg, which has seen power cuts, water cuts, freezing weather, compounding the misery that millions of people have felt. Clyde Mallinson is the independent energy analyst. He is with us this evening on the line to us from Johannesburg. Eskom is failing more and more often and perhaps faster than we may have hoped for, Clyde. Is it properly falling apart, or is this just part of a pattern that we should have anticipated and continue to expect?
Evening, Bruce. They're actually holding it together better than I would have expected, if that's possible.
No, that's
so
good.
Yeah, when you don't do planned maintenance when you mean to have, there is no such thing as catching up maintenance. You've kind of lost your relationship with your steam turbine, and you can't win back that relationship by giving it extra special tender loving care, as it were. So when you go in to do that maintenance that you haven't carried out, what you find is you cut open the turbine to replace the appendix, you see that the liver needs replacing and that the one kidney is wonky. In other words, The reality of the situation now is that as Eskom does this deep backlog maintenance, they're finding out that the state of their coal fleet is in worse shape than what they had hoped for. And we all know that if you have an old vehicle or something and you pop the top to change the piston rings, odds are you're going to find a crack in the engine block. And I'm afraid at this point in time, we need clarity on this. You know, we did this deep maintenance and we need to report to you that it's actually worse than we thought. And so we need to declare an emergency to the extent that we almost need to rally the military to help us install what we need to install as a replacement fleet. It's literally a Marshall Plan where we need a couple of field marshals to enact the Marshall Plan to help us. That's the situation, I'm afraid. So we're right on the edge at the moment. And if any other units were to fall over, if that conveyor belt at Madupi had to snap again, or if another silo at Majuba had to crack, I'm afraid we would be plunged into sort of permanent stage four, maybe even worse load shedding.
Okay, we don't need you to be tempting fate yet, Clyde. Let's work with what we do know, but thank you for the warning. What do you make of Kulu Pasiwe's comment? Kulu has spent many years at Eskom speaking on behalf of the company. I'm just saying tonight that, you know, there are plenty of engineers, perfectly capable engineers, South African engineers, who are capable of ultimately helping solve Eskom's multiplicity of problems. What is it about Eskom that it's not engaging directly with these people? I thought 12, 18 months ago this was part of the plan. It doesn't seem to have happened.
I think the biggest problem is the disconnect. Eskom are not in a position to say what the new build is going to be. And I think Eskom have realized for some time that we need to have pulled out all the stops on putting in more wind and solar and storage, and they have not been allowed to do that. So the RP is set by the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, and they say this is how much you're allowed to do, and in the meantime, try and get that old coal fleet working. And Eskom have said, but we'd really like, no, don't do that. Get the old coal fleet working, and we'll tell you how much of these other things you can build. And that's been the problem. We've basically had a 5 or 6 year hiatus where we haven't procured any new wind, solar, or storage. And now we're having to play catch up. And when you're playing catch up, it doesn't work. You know, you're tarring the road while the traffic's got to run on the road. So all of those engineers that are available, their job would be to nurse the dying coal fleet to squeeze as much out of it as we can over the next 10 years. And we need to build a replacement that gives us the headroom to allow us to shut down the coal fleet with dignity. It's done us proud, but it needs now one by one to be retired and buried with dignity. And instead, what's happening is as one or other of the units die off, there's a mad panic and a scramble, and there's no dignified burial at all. And that's what we need to do. We need to build ourselves the headroom to allow us to logistically and in a dignified fashion retire the coal fleet. That's it.
Also, when it comes to staff performance, I mean, unions were quoted this week that saying that workers become more accident prone and tired if they don't get 15% salary increases, and that's union brinkmanship to the nth degree. But one area where the chief executive of Eskom, André de Ruyter, won a lot of public respect, and I'm sure won a lot of respect within Eskom, was one of the first things he did in the early stages of Eskom was to invite everybody to the boardroom, all the power station managers to a boardroom at Eskom. Yes. He painted the wall in the boardroom because it was tatty and it just symbolized them, the crumbling edifice. And he gave them an ultimatum: get your stuff sorted out, get your piles of coal in piles, neaten the place up, otherwise there's going to be trouble. Most responded, a couple didn't. He fired and suspended a few people. Tonight we see that the Kuberg Nuclear Power Station general manager, a guy called Velapi Ntuli, has been suspended over performance-related issues. One wonders just how important this issue of individual power station performances and of leadership at these power stations, and also whether the unions have a point in terms of morale inside Eskom.
Look, first of all, addressing the morale, I think the morale is very low at the moment. You know, Eskom are working, the sort of repair staff or the maintenance staff are working harder and harder, and they're working at an impossible task. We have to say, this year we expect to get X out of the Eskom coal fleet. Next year, X minus 10%. Next year, X minus 20%. So that you have a goal and you can say, phew, I can bury Hendrina with some dignity. I can close Komati and give the people who work there jobs in building renewable. But you can't sort of hold a whip over the guys when they're working 24/7 to keep the plants running and expect them to perform miracles with old plants. I mean, a quick example would be if you're in a boiler and the tubes are leaking and you cut out a section of tubes to replace them. You kind of look at where you've made the cut and you see, gee, this tube where we've made the cut, the other part of the tube's also thin. It just happens to be leaking where we cut it out. But we can almost see when we weld a new tube in that we're welding to a paper-thin old tube, if you see what I'm getting at. You're on a hiding to nothing. So the best we can do is nurse the old patients through, I'm afraid, and we've got to recognise that. And I don't know that skilled engineers can change that at this point. I mean, they can improve it, but I mean to be setting targets where we're saying the coal's currently doing X number of kilowatt hours a year, and we expect it to do X plus 20. That ain't going to happen. It's doing X and it needs to be 0.9, 0.8, 0.7, not 1.1, 1.2, because it ain't going to go up.
The car power story is interesting. I mean, this is going to fight this is going to be a massive battle over car power. I can't see them being brought here, certainly not for a 20-year period. The alternative energy sources, of course, and the frustration among so many in the independent power producing sector about just government dragging its feet on policy, government dragging its feet on allowing these guys to come in and help solve the problem. There's so much goodwill, so much desire, so much opportunity to solve the problem, either incapacity, incompetence, or incoherence within the department.
Yeah, let me give you a good example. City Power of Johannesburg are wanting to procure from IPPs, and they've had a number of meetings recently. Now, it turns out that the City of Joburg, under control of City Power, uses about as much power as what the car power ships are going to generate, maybe a little bit more, but it's on same order of magnitude. City of Johannesburg currently loses a quarter of a billion rand a year on its distribution business. So it buys from Eskom from X. It loses a whole lot through technical reasons, but it also loses a whole lot through bad billing, non-payment and theft. So it ends up, at the end of the day, they're about a quarter of a billion in the red, and that's growing. They haven't got a debt to Eskom, they've got an overdraft because they're big enough to have an overdraft. Now, City of Johannesburg could purchase up to 80% of its power from IPPs, wind and solar, and they could save 3 billion rand a year if they did that. So they could turn a quarter of a billion rand into a 3 billion or two and three quarter billion rand profit. And the best bit is, I'm sure the City of Joburg residents would all love to chip in and buy shares in these wind and solar plants that are supplying themselves with power and get a good dividend from it, better than they're currently getting from their retirement annuities. So you're multi-solving there. You're turning City Power from a loss-making operation into a healthy profit-making operation. And of course, they can use some of those profits then to fix up issues on the distribution grid. They can put in storage at pinch points. They can spend money on refurbishing the distribution grid. But the best bit is that the people of Johannesburg would be getting a dividend because they would have the opportunity to own a share in a community-owned IPP. And that's the kind of thinking we need to go at. So Joburg could be 80% green before 2030. And it would be doing it at about a third of the price of what we're looking to pay the car power ships.
And that's the point. We've really got to think about this stuff differently. Thank you, independent energy analyst Clyde Mallinson, this evening, helping us out on that particular story. A multiplicity of issues coming to the fore there as well. But I mean, so all of these problems are fixable. They are all fixable. But we seem incapable of getting the right people in the right place at the right time, with the right tools, with the right budgets, with the right power to do them.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Well, the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's been meeting the group of seven finance ministers in London, and she's looking for support to rewrite international tax rules to discourage American companies from booking earnings abroad. And it's these huge tech companies that duck and dive their tax obligations absolutely everywhere and end up paying not very much anywhere at all. Gary McNamara, portfolio manager at Sundlam Private Wealth. How worried should investors be? Because we look at the huge weighting of these massive technology companies that manage to avoid paying their appropriate amount of taxes in different jurisdictions around the globe, and their valuations are sky high, and they've taken the S&P to sky high levels, the Dow to sky high levels. I wonder if Janet Yellen and Joe Biden get this right and manage to extract more tax from these companies, what happens to the profits, and then what happens to the value of the underlying shares, and ultimately your and my retirement one day.
Yes, Bruce, it's something the market's been aware of certainly since President Biden got elected, and I think the governments globally, not just America, have to collect a bit more tax. So it's an obviously easy one to try and get people to pay a little bit more tax back in their home jurisdiction. But what you end up finding happening at the end of the day is that you get some sort of middle ground gets achieved. But I think the market is already expecting some of these tax rates that they're going to be paying to go up a little bit, but it's certainly not going to be paying 25% or 20% of their tax bill like we would in South Africa. So I think they are still going to get away with some sort of tax break, but it's going to go up, and I think Mr. Biden needs to collect the tax, but I think it's going to be a bit of a middle ground.
Well, it has to be. I mean, just the chaos that would ensue if these guys got nailed for taxes. Tell you what's really interesting is the fight over Adapt IT. It's in deliciously, heisgenotely messy. The people fighting over assets. The boss has been suspended or asked for some leave because he's accused of getting his ex's partner beaten up. I mean, it's just an unholy mess. But Volaris, which is the Canadian company, has upped its cash offer from R6.50 to R7. Now, this the board says the consideration is fair and reasonable. Previously, it said the offer from Volaris was unfair but reasonable. And then it says that the huge offer is unfair and unreasonable. I mean, boy, I've had a lesson in semantics this week in terms of the language that these guys are using. But bottom line is, Adapt IT's board is suggesting to their shareholders that they back Volaris and accept R7 a share and put this whole issue to bed.
Yeah, it's a complicated one, and I guess you've got two companies wanting the same assets. One's got cash and one's got shares. The problem that you've got with a huge offer at one that's gone up to 1.37 huge shares for every Adapt IT share is that it's a fairly illiquid share, and it's also quite difficult to follow the company. So they are paying effectively in share price a premium. It works out at about R7.50. But in the uncertain times, not that we're too uncertain at the moment, we certainly moved forward from those days, the R7 the board is saying is probably fair and reasonable from that side. But I would just leave it to shareholders. It's a difficult one, and I guess it's messy. But, you know, let shareholders decide which way they want. And my understanding is, a shareholder, you can actually put your shares out as a cash offer, or if you don't want that, you've got the option for the huge offer as well. So I think they've left it to shareholders to decide, and I think that's the right way forward.
Yeah, MultiChoice come out of the strong trading update, but possibly the biggest story of the day, Wendy Lucas-Bull, who has chaired APSA for about a decade, has announced that she will be stepping down in March next year. Now, people are going to connect this to the resignation of Daniel Minnelli and the fact that Daniel Minnelli didn't feel that he had the board support in the face of executive pushback within APSA, and so he resigned. But I've been waiting for Wendy Lucas-Bull's retirement for some time. She joined the board of ShopRite a while back, and it's massively unusual for a bank chair to be on a different board, because the job of chairing a bank is so absolutely enormous. So I'm looking at this and saying I get where everyone's mind is going to be on this, but I caution leaping to conclusions around her decision to step down at this point, because she was going off to ShopRite anyway.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, definitely her strength, as you highlight, has been the banking sector. That's where she's cut her teeth and where she's extremely well known, and she's been at APSA for a while. I don't know, there's been so many rumors in terms of the fallout of the previous APSA CEO. I just think that this may be a lack of execution in terms of the tough environment, but it'll be interesting to see how it goes forward. But she probably feels she's done her time, 10 years at the helm, even if not as operating capacity. It's quite a long time in the modern era, and I think the more you get people to implement their changes and then give somebody else a chance, the better. 10 years, I think, is a fairly good period of time.
Thank you, Gary McNamara at Sanlam Private Wealth.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking. This year's winners of Global Finance Most Innovative Bank in Africa, the Innovators Awards 2021. That's Africanacity. APSA's a registered FSP.
Our Friday file coming up in a moment. We'll play the Brutal Biz quiz before 7 this evening. And after that, after Eyewitness News at 7, we will bring you the best bits of the Money Show, including a fabulous Other People's Money featured this week with the chief economist at Alexander Forbes, Isaac Mhlanga, and speaking from the heart and really incredibly powerful lessons from him on money, attitudes towards money, and the power of being the big earner in the family. Big one. It's a really important one. Coming up next time on The Money Show, we've got the renowned pianist, entertainer, musical director, and cocktail connoisseur. Who knew? Rocco de Villiers on Other People's Money. We get into his love for short pants, multicolored pianos, and his philosophy towards money and investing. The important stuff, you see. And then in our books feature, we'll chat to certified financial planner Kim Porchita. Her new book, The Midlife Money Makeover. That's coming up next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Modiri Mafantiri is the co-founder and operations director at Barali. Now, Barali is a brand and design consultancy which has developed traditional handcrafts from Lesotho. They make a most beautiful array of traditional woolen rugs, fabrics, even socks I see on their Instagram account. Modiri, welcome to The Money Show this evening. I mean, one thinks about Lesotho and one has a traditional image of Basotho blankets and woven conical hats. And it does talk to, I suppose, a long tradition of weaving there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, no, definitely our Basotho blankets and our traditional hats are indicative of a weaving industry. But for us, you know, we really wanted to build a brand that would focus on, you know, our mohair and wool industry, which is the majority of the textile industry, actually.
Now, talk to me about the textile industry in Lesotho, because, I mean, of course, Angora goats can survive under tough conditions, and Lesotho is a tough place for survival. It's not got much nor natural vegetation. It's a tough environment. Talk to me about that, Angora, the woolen industry in Lesotho.
Okay, so one of our biggest exports as a country is really our wool and mohair. So that's really something that we wanted to incorporate into our products, because our weavers have a very long history of making blankets and making blankets and tapestries out of these materials. So when we intended to create a brand, we really just wanted to make sure that we're using our own locally sourced products, and this would include our locally sourced mohair.
And how big is it? I mean, how big an industry is it in Lesotho?
How big of an industry is it in Lesotho? Okay, I can't give you the exact percentages.
No, but I mean, just give me a sense of it. I mean, are there 20 factories? Are there 50 factories? Is it a massive export earner, or are you the only guys in town?
Oh, no. We're definitely not the only guys in town. The wool and mohair industry is very big. It's very big. So I would say, in terms of looking at our textile exports, so we would say clothing, and then we would say wool and mohair.
Okay. So, I mean, and again, the clothing industry goes back to, and a lot of that, though, I mean, a lot of that clothing industry, those exports, I mean, my limited understanding is there are quite a lot of Chinese factories, I think, in Lesotho, which manufacture clothing for export. So that is this. But this is indigenous. This is stuff that goes back generations. I mean, what is the traditional, what is the tradition of weaving in Lesotho?
So, yes, much like you said, it really is something that goes all the way back. So probably, I would say, to the early 900s, really, 1900s, sorry. So what happened is that there were a lot of missionaries that came to Lesotho and actually transferred the skills of weaving with woolen mohair to local Basotho women. And women are the custodians of the skill in Lesotho. And so for a very long time, that's what's been happening. But unfortunately, with the introduction of more modern ways of producing textiles, we've actually seen, like you mentioned, a move into the clothing industry. So the woolen mohair industry, in terms of people producing textiles, it's kind of decreased over time, which is why it's important for us to bring that back into a modern context.
But the process, and I'm just looking at your Instagram account, and I'm seeing an old-fashioned spinning wheel, as you might be if you're familiar with the story of Rapunzel living up in the tower, and there's a spinning wheel and the sharp needle, a very similar-looking machine. But, I mean, gloriously, you know, the spinning wheel is a bicycle wheel. And a really quite ancient-looking but modern-built, a new-built spinning wheel made out of planks, and really, I mean, an artisanal development if I've ever seen one, where somebody sat down and made a plan with some wood, some nails, and a bicycle wheel, and has created a spinning wheel to take the wool and turn it into thread. It's the most astonishing level of innovation. It really is.
It really is, and it's something that is also quite old. But the ones that you probably see on our Instagram are actually ones that have been produced in Lesotho.
Yeah.
So the weavers are quite big on doing everything by hand. So the raw woolen mohair that comes in just bales, essentially, is then spun by hand into the yarn, and then they will hand make the tapestries, or they will hand make the blankets, or hand make rugs.
Talk to me about the your involvement and what got you involved. How did you begin the process? Because I look at the finished quality of these products, and they are lovely. I'm looking at a burnt orange rug of it's beautiful and rough. I mean, with mohair, you've got to feel the texture. You've got to understand that you're not going to wear this as a mohair shirt. It's going to be scratchy, but my goodness me, it's going to be warm and glorious. Talk to me about your involvement.
Okay. So when my partner and I decided to mostly focus on woolen mohair, our involvement was really just to source or to highlight rather the strength of our local weavers. So the weavers that we work with are master weavers, and they're based all across the country. So some are based in the capital city and some are based in neighboring districts. So what we do is that we draw inspiration from our cultures, and then that is put on paper into design. And then we take the design to our weavers and see how exactly we can make something happen together.
And the dyeing of the wool, because, I mean, wool in its natural form is beautiful, but you've got a wider range of colors. I mean, pastel shades across I look at the swatches that you guys produce. Where is the dyeing getting done? Is that a traditional process as well, or is that more industrial?
Oh, no, it's also a traditional process. So right after they spin the wool or the mohair into yarn, they then put it mostly in traditional black iron pots outside, and they dunk the wool and mohair into the dyes, and they leave that out to dry. So again, and a very hands-on project.
And the dyes are made how?
No, those are definitely synthetic, because I mean, a lot of artisans in the textile industry will tell you that it's best to move towards natural dyes. However, the problem with that is the longevity of that, and the dyes just simply don't last, and they cannot hold.
That is a big problem. How do you reach markets? I mean, where are your markets? How do you get your products out into the market? Because for people working in this environment, it's massively labor intensive. It's huge skill required to do it, and everybody needs to get paid at the end of the day.
Yes, no, definitely everyone does need to get paid at the end of the day. And on that note, you know, ethical wages are one of our central values. So the marketplaces that we are selling our products through are international marketplaces. So the majority of our clients are based out of Lesotho. And so, for example, the marketplaces that you could access in South Africa if you wanted to purchase are Aya Africa, and they are a Cape Town-based marketplace. If you are in Europe, that would be the White Label Project in Sweden. It would be an Ugo in Warsaw, Poland. But and there are a couple other marketplaces.
Proportionately, your exports, I mean, is it mostly a South African export, or is it go? Do you see bigger demand coming from Northern Hemisphere countries?
It's definitely coming from Northern Hemisphere countries, because we find that, you know, the sustainable market, it's really not something that's picking up at the same steam here on the African continent as much as it is in Europe and in the Americas, which is something that we wish, you know, we could do something about, but it is what it is.
Yeah, you got to go where the money is. You got to go where the market is. You got to go where people are going to appreciate the craft are. And if they're not here, well, then everybody else will get the benefit of your work. Beautiful products. Have a look at Barali. You will find them on Instagram. You'll find a website as well online, Barali. And that is the co-founder and operations director at Barali, Modiege Mafandiri.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Coming up in a moment, the Brutal Biz Quiz. Let's play it on this Friday night on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. It's crunch time. It's crunch time for employees of which big global tech firm? Bosses are telling staff they need to return for at least 3 days a week from September. Which company is calling crunch time on work from home? 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. Give us a shout if you want to play this evening's edition of the Brutal Biz Quiz.
702.
SMS Bruce.
On 31702.
Lines are open this evening. We're going to play the Brutal Biz Quiz on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. Crunch time for employees of which big global tech company? Bosses want them to return to the office by September. Sean in Highlands North.
Hi, Bruce. That's Apple.
Apple, absolutely. Crunch time at Apple. They've been told they need to return 3 days a week in early September. Tim Cook, the chief executive, saying most employees will be asked to come to the office on Mondays, Tuesdays and Thursdays. The option of working remotely Wednesdays and Fridays. Teams that need to work in person will have to come back more regularly. A Grand Parade is trying to sell what, Sean?
Burger King, I think.
You're absolutely right. You sounded hesitant and concerned, but you're absolutely right. Competition Commission this week recommending the sale of Burger King be prohibited. The prohibition is because the buyers, they're private equity players called Emerging Capital Partners. They're based in Washington, D.C., don't have a black empowerment status, and therefore their BEE credentials are lower than those of Grand Parade, and therefore Grand Parade isn't allowed to sell to them. And you kind of go, hold on a second, but that doesn't that prejudice the BE shareholders of Grand Parade? This one's likely to go to court. Wendy Lucas Bull is outgoing chair of which South African bank?
That's ABSA.
Which South African retail bank was she chief executive of previously?
I think it was FNB.
You're good at this, Sean. Not many people would remember that, but you're absolutely right. She was replaced by Michael Jordan. Wendy Lucas Bull went on to chair the APSA Group, the group announcing today she'll step down by March next year. Which JSE-listed company is buying Stack Overflow? Now, Sibonisongomalo from Old Mutual Investment Group, we spoke to him about this last night, and he described Stack Overflow as Google for nerds. It's a tech company, a South African listed. It's not domiciled in South Africa, but it is listed on the JSE, is buying Stack Overflow. What is the name of that company?
Is this not MultiChoice's holding company? I forget the name.
Three, two.
That own 10 cents.
One. And you have to move forward on this one, Sean. You have to go forward. That's what it is in Latin. The name of the company in Latin is Forward. But you don't know, do you? We're going to have to let you go, no. Sean. Oh, I don't want to cut you. I know it's the Brutal Biz quiz, but you've done so well. Done so well. Sean, you're a sport. Well done. Alex in Pretoria, who is buying Stack Overflow?
Process
is absolutely right. Sean in Highlands North is at the moment sitting and banging his head against a wall or on his desk or his phone against his forehead because he knew the answer and couldn't get it out. Yeah, the Google for nerds. Which minister denied this week that he was involved in the evaluation of bids for emergency power? And I want you to say it in his voice.
Gwede Montashe.
Gwede. No! You've got to go deeper. You've got to go gruffer. You've got to go gruffer. Absolutely gruffer. But yes, Gwede Montashe. He's denied in an affidavit that he was involved in the evaluation of bids for emergency power, but it's all an unholy mess. I think we're going to make you the Wizard of the Biz quiz, Alex. Well done to you. Congratulations. Thank you for playing. The Biz quiz is lovely because what we like to do is we like to test your knowledge of what we've been doing on the radio and what's in the news generally. Then see whether or not your answers cut the mustard. And invariably, you guys do very, very well indeed. Sometimes I win, but most of the time you guys win. And it's lovely to test your grey matter on a Friday night. A bit of fun to wrap up the first hour of the show. Coming up in the next hour is the Best Bits of the Money Show. Included in tonight's Best Bits, we have got the part of the interview that we did with the chief economist at Alexander Forbes, and he was talking to us earlier this week all about this concept of black tax and why he doesn't buy into it, not for a moment. Such an interesting perspective from Isaac Mhlanga. We're going to hear that coming up in a moment after Eyewitness News at 7.